From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Iraq was supposed to be a quick victory. It wasn't. Now analysts say there are only two ways to address the problem of an overstretched U.S. military: more troops or less fighting. And with at least 51 people killed again today in Iraq and 230 wounded, there is no end to the fighting in sight. The president has maintained that if his generals need more soldiers to beat the insurgency, then they'll have them. But the question these days is where the troops will come from, even to sustain their current levels. If the problem is going to be solved, that is, it's not going to be cheap and it's not going to be easy, and it may not be someone else's children solving it. But ignoring the problem, analysts now say, is no longer an option. Tonight on Point, the overstretched U.S. military and what will be done about it. Has the U.S. military bitten off more than it can chew with its current force structure? If the military is short of troops, what should be done? Higher pay? Even longer tours of duty? A draft? Are you in the military? Have you or a friend served in Iraq? Have you seen evidence of overstretch? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Washington is Mark Mazzetti, defense reporter for the Los Angeles Times. Mark, thanks so much for joining us tonight.
Sure. Thanks for having me.
I want to turn in a moment to this new report that the Pentagon has today on the being stretched so thin. But I have to turn first to a couple of pieces of news from Iraq. First, the one we've been hearing about all day, these terrible car bombings, something like 39-40 children killed, 51 maybe in total around Iraq today, 230 wounded, a huge total today. How is this drumbeat of bombings and death totals, including more U.S. casualties today, being received at the Pentagon, Mark?
Well, the Pentagon is certainly increasingly concerned that here we are 3 months after the handover of sovereignty in Iraq, and not only are things not getting better with the insurgency, they're actually getting worse. The number of attacks are going up, the incidences are going up, and the number of U.S. troops being killed is going up. So the reports are greeted with tremendous concern, especially these terrorist attacks, what they call vehicle-borne IEDs, you know, car bombings,
right,
that are done by people who, you know, they're not really sure who does them, but they think it's men aligned with Abu Musab Zarqawi, the chief terrorist in Iraq. So I think there's concern in the Pentagon that this enemy certainly is gaining in strength.
Reports today that at the celebration opening the sewage plant outside of Baghdad, American troops called the kids over for candy. The kids came, and somebody drove a car bomb in the middle. It's just gruesome.
That's right. I was in Iraq last month, and these types of attacks occur with much greater frequency, I think, than the American public really gets to learn about them. They're attacks not only in the so-called Sunni Triangle, not only in Baghdad. They happen all the time throughout the country, and the military doesn't necessarily always report them to the public. So they happen with all too great frequency over there.
And then, Mark, before we get to troop strength, I have to just touch on this. Here we are an hour or two before the presidential debate, and CNN is reporting a major operation underway in Samarra. In the Sunni Triangle, a brigade-sized force of U.S. troops, they're reporting, nearing the center of the city, apparently going after some 2,000 insurgents in Samarra. Is this the beginning of the long-awaited push to try and bring U.S. control or Iraqi government control back to the large areas of Iraq that are now no-go or have been no-go zones?
Yeah, I think it is. When I was there in August, actually Samarra was top on the list of the commanders of places they needed to deal with. That offensive actually got put on hold. They were actually planning, I think, for mid to late August. And as you remember, the uprising in Najaf occurred, and basically that diverted the attention of the U.S. military in Iraq towards that city. They had to basically hold off on the Samarra operation. They tried a political solution. That has not worked. The Iraqi imposed officials in Samarra basically have buckled under the pressure of the insurgents. So it looks like they've decided that the military solution is the only one they can take at this point. But, yeah, I think this is the first city that they're going to be dealing with in this new offensive.
And the timing of this significant operation, should we make anything of the fact that U.S. Troops are marching into harm's way as the president and John Kerry prepare to face off?
it's tough to say. The people on the ground in Baghdad, the commanders will say that they're completely independent and that they do not time operations around the political or the electoral calendar. I'm sure that the conspiracy theorists or cynics will probably read something into that.
And now the theme of our discussion this evening, Mark Mazzetti, report in today saying the U.S. military lacks sufficient personnel to meet the nation's current war and peacekeeping demands throughout the world, not to mention its potential projected future demands. Who's saying this? How serious is the problem?
This is a report that came out last month by the Defense Science Board, which is a group of outside experts that the Pentagon hires to assess big issues of national security. And the one that they dealt with this summer is essentially how the U.S. military can deal with its many global commitments now and in the future, particularly the so-called peacekeeping or stability operations, such as we're doing right now in Iraq and Afghanistan, these long-term nation-building assignments that are really a drain on the U.S. forces. The Army last year predicted by this time this year they'd have just 8 brigades in Iraq. There are currently 20 Army brigades in Iraq.
Wow.
And as you said in your setup, this is has great implications for the future, especially since, as we say, the enemy isn't getting any weaker on retention, recruiting, that type of thing.
So last week, Senator Jack Reed of Rhode Island cited this report, which had not been publicly announced, I guess, during his congressional testimony questioning Donald Rumsfeld on it. Now we're getting some more detail. What exactly is this advisory group saying?
Well, it's interesting. Reed questioned Rumsfeld last week about the report, and Rumsfeld's response was essentially, well, we don't think the report, the panel was really briefed on all the initiatives going on in the Pentagon, specifically the Army's efforts to increase its number of troops. Well, actually, a copy of the report shows that the panel did indeed consider these Pentagon initiatives and these Army initiatives, and they still felt that they weren't enough. And the background of this whole debate is really Democrats and even some Republicans like John McCain say there is no way we can go forward without increasing the total number of U.S. troops. The Pentagon, specifically Rumsfeld, has adamantly denied this and says we do not need an overall increase in strength. We just need to be more efficient with our current numbers and save the taxpayers the money. So this is debate that hasn't gotten any less intense, and it'll probably become more intense, certainly until the election.
And the Army saying yesterday that it's met most of its recruiting goals for 2004, but signaling it expects much more difficulty next year, and the Army National Guard saying it is falling short of its 2004 recruiting goal.
That's right. The Guard, for the first time in a while, missed its recruiting goals for 2004. The Army active force did meet its goals, but they are, expecting darkening clouds ahead. I think that there is concern in the Army, and you even can see it when you're in Baghdad, just at the anecdotal level. People who go over for a year and then sometimes have to pull back-to-back assignments. There's people in Baghdad who are on their second tour of duty because they changed units, and that unit was then being deployed to Iraq. You can't sustain it for that long and not have some major impact on an all-volunteer force. So I think there is a lot of concern. Again, the numbers thus far haven't really borne out a major crisis. There's beginning to show, like for instance in the National Guard data, but by this time next year you might start seeing that.
But part of the reason the numbers are holding up is that they've got this so-called stop-loss order that's preventing people from actually leaving active duty.
That is right. It's a sort of artificial floor to the numbers falling below a certain level. What it is that certain units are not letting people leave if there's a certain window before which that unit then deploys to Iraq or Afghanistan. So, it's you sign a contract with the military for 5 years or so, and in many cases you get kept longer because of quote-unquote stop loss. The Pentagon keeps you there because you're considered essential.
And it looks like these days almost everyone is essential. Mark Mazzetti, thanks so much for being with us tonight.
Sure, thanks.
Mark Mazzetti, defense reporter for the Los Angeles Times. I am joined now by Cindy Williams. She's a principal research scientist in the Security Studies Program at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, editor of Filling the Ranks, Transforming the U.S. Military Personnel System. She served as a member of the Senior Executive Service in the Office of the Secretary of Defense. Cindy Williams, thanks for being with us tonight.
Thank you for inviting me.
And we are joined from Cambridge, Massachusetts, by John White, chairman of the Middle East Initiative at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. He served as Assistant Secretary of Defense for Manpower, Reserve Affairs and Logistics from 1977 to 78, and Deputy Secretary of Defense again from 1995 to 97. John White, thank you for being with us tonight.
Thank you.
So we are reading and hearing on many fronts, Cindy Williams, that we have got some real stretch going on and concerns of a much more significant and difficult overstretch in the U.S. military in the years ahead. How do you assess the situation right now? Is it okay as it stands? Is the problem next year, or is it are we already well into it?
I think what the Defense Science Board report pointed out and what Mark started to get at was that the Army is in an overstretched situation that it wouldn't be in if this had been a very short operation in Iraq.
The operation that was expected, the one that would mean 8 brigades there now instead of 20.
Exactly, because the Army can do big things for a short period of time, but it can't sustain large operations for a long duration without rotating people in and out. And that's what Mark was talking about, that the Army doesn't like to leave troops in place in an operation in a theater, especially one as difficult as Iraq, for more than a year. They're talking now even about making the tour of duty be 6 months because it's just too difficult for people.
But if they do that, they don't have enough troops to go around.
That means they need to rotate units in and out. And the idea they have in their minds is that they could have a unit that's just come home, a unit that's in the field, and a unit that's getting ready to go. And
that, so that would be the ideal, you're saying?
That would be the ideal, or maybe even more than that.
Mm-hmm.
And they don't have anywhere near the number of units to maintain that kind of 3-to-1 rotation base. And that's why people say they're in an overstretched situation. But there are other reasons to believe that they're in an overstretched situation. You know, Mark talked about the recruiting and retention holding up, and in many ways it's surprising that they're doing as well as they are.
It is remarkable. Given the death toll there and all the scenes that we're seeing, it's not an easy tour.
Yes, but as you pointed out, the stop-loss masks problems that you might have seen in retention, and there's a little trick going on in the accounting with the recruits that masks what might be going on with recruiting. Recruiting numbers are holding up. By and large, throughout the active duty Army, they've got a 10% shortfall relative to their goal in the Army National Guard.
And the pipeline is not what it normally would be.
But the pipeline is the problem, because normally the Army runs a delayed entry program, and they like to have some people that they recruit this year hold off on training until next year. And this year they're not able to do it. So they're basically borrowing from next year's class. So there's a recruiting problem probably coming next year.
John White, we're hearing and reading reports of troops being recruited, of National Guardsmen being called up and pushed essentially to the front in Iraq with pretty, dazzling or alarming speed, depending how you look at it. Are the troop levels, are they sucking wind? Are they up against it?
I think I agree with Cindy. I think the troop levels are not adequate for the task. And unfortunately, we've seen this now for a couple of years. We've known this, and the administration has been very resistant in terms of adding troops, largely, I think, because of the money involved and because they had taken an earlier position that the war would go better, of course, and be over. And as a result of that, we've gotten ourselves into a bigger and bigger bind here.
How serious, how big, we'll look at prescriptions, but how big an answer is needed for this? Do we need a real rethink of the U.S. military force structure?
No, well, the Army is doing a rethink of the force structure, which I think is a good thing to do in terms of how they actually organize themselves and fight. But what we really need to do, I think, is redouble our efforts here in terms of what we're doing. This is not yet a national emergency of some kind. This is still something that I think is manageable inside the institutions that we have today. The all-volunteer force has been an enormous success. I think it's one of the most successful social policies of the last 50 years. When you see all those wonderful high-tech weapons in Iraq in the war, what you're really seeing is a lot of smart, brave soldiers.
But we hear John McCain saying this war, if it's not fought differently, could break exactly that volunteer force that you're speaking of. Cindy Williams, John White, please stand by. We have to take a short break. We're talking about the overstretched U.S. military. Has the U.S. military bitten off more than it can chew with its current force structure? If the U.S. military is short of troops, what should be done? Higher pay? Even longer tours of duty? A draft What do you think? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the overstretched U.S. military and what will be done about it. Are you in the military? Have you or a relative or friend served in Iraq, Afghanistan? Have you seen evidence of the overstretch? And how do you hear the warnings and complaints from National Guardsmen and reserves these days? Did they sign up for this, or are they being misused, overused? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm joined by Cindy Williams from MIT, John White from Harvard's Kennedy School. Cindy, we read some incredible reports lately about things getting a little rocky out there. Here we are, our friend Tom Ricks reporting in the Washington Post just last week about 600-some soldiers of a battalion of South Carolina National Guard locked down in Fort Dix, New Jersey, because they were about to be sent to Iraq after months of very intensive, fast-paced training without any home leave, and they were sort of revolting at this. What are you hearing about morale in the Guard, in the active-duty military? How is the burden of duty wearing when there aren't a lot of reinforcements to come in?
Yeah, I think the situation is the worst for the Army National Guard and the Army Reserve. And the reason is that they feel the most sort of cheated relative to what they expected life was going to be like in the Guard and Reserve. They didn't anticipate that they'd be called up for 18 months at a time to go fight in a counterinsurgency that's this difficult and maybe be called up repeatedly. And we are starting, you know, one of the most telling things is we're starting to see a real decrease in their reported morale as reported through an official Department of Defense survey called the Status of Forces Survey. So looking from May 2003 until May 2004, there was a significant decline in the levels of support by the families of Guard and Reserve members mm-hmm. for their continued participation in the Reserve, support by their employers for their continued participation in the Guard and Reserve. But worst of all, there was a serious decline in their own reported intention to stay in the military if they're offered the opportunity to do that. Now, believe it or not, all of, you know, the figures are still holding up at about the 50% level. So about 50% of Guard and Reserve say that their families support them, mm-hmm. that they're ready to stay in the military if they are offered the opportunity, that they still see the military as a good way of life. So it's not disaster, but the decline is a serious indicator that there are potential problems to come. And we're not seeing this level of decline in the active forces yet, but to tell you the truth, we haven't had a recent survey on the active forces, so it's hard to know how bad it'll be when the numbers come out from the most recent surveys.
We're going to hear a voice recently from the front in a moment, but John White, first let me ask you, could you just define for us current force levels, what they are? And with 20 brigades in Iraq, no end to that in sight, and the possibility, it would appear that in the next couple of years there could be significant situations on the Korean Peninsula or even with Iran. What does the U.S. force level need to be?
Well, I think generally there's a certain consensus among people. You mentioned Senator McCain and others who think there ought to be at least a 40,000 troop increase in the size of the army or of the ground combat forces.
And that would take it from what to what, John?
Cindy, that would take it to...
If we add 40,000,
right,
is that...
Right now, the active duty force is at about 1.37 million.
Yeah, but the Army's at about...
360?
No, the Army is about 506,000 active duty troops.
Active duty.
Okay, so just over a 10% increase there.
10% increase. And... now that takes, you have to recognize you don't do that overnight. You have to recruit the people, you have to train them, and you have to equip them.
Is 40,000 increase considered a medium, small, big increase?
A modest size increase, but one that will stretch the recruiting efforts certainly. But we should recognize that in the 70s and the 80s, we recruited as many as double what we recruit today, and this program has been successful, of course, for 30 years. So. But not in the midst of a war. So there are, as Cindy said, I think there are real concerns, but the system seems to be holding up.
40,000, and that would do it, Cindy Williams? Is that all we're talking about here?
Well, my preference, because of the strain that we're putting on the guard and the fact that guardsmen are complaining that they didn't sign up for this,
yeah.
I mean, I think a better choice would be to replace as much of the guard in Iraq as possible with active duty forces. And if you really wanted to do that and have a rotation base for it, it would take you 100,000 or even more active duty troops.
About 40% of the troops in Iraq now are National Guard, if I've got that right.
Yeah. Now, one thing people don't always talk about is the fact that even though the Army is overstretched, in fact, the two services that aren't participating much in Iraq and Afghanistan, the Navy and the Air Force, have more people than they're authorized and more people than they want. Right now, the Air Force has about 24,000 people than it's really allowed to have. The Navy is looking to drop 60,000 people from its roles over the next decade. And so
Not exactly interchangeable, though. I mean, if you're in the Navy, you're not going to become an Army infantryman.
Well, believe it or not, there's a program called Blue to Green in which the Air Force is sending people directly into the Army, but the people have to volunteer to do it. But my point is only that our military is able to bring in this many people. It would still be able to bring in this many people, I think, if you were bringing them in as Army, not Navy or Air Force.
Maybe, but everybody can see who's on the ground in Iraq having to bust down those doors and deal with this tough duty. I want to bring into our conversation from New York City Paul Rykoff. He's a lieutenant in the New York National Guard. He spent 10 months in combat operations as an infantry platoon leader in Iraq. He's executive director and founder of a group called Operation Truth. He's 29 years old. He reenlisted after he was released from duty at the end of March. Paul Rykoff, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you very much, sir.
We're looking tonight at how the U.S. military is being stretched by Afghanistan, by Iraq in particular. You have direct experience of that in the Guard. Did you see evidence of an overstretched military during your time there, Paul?
Yeah, absolutely. What I've seen also within the National Guard and Reserves, and mind you, I've been in since 1998, is absolute and total neglect and underfunding of the Guard and Reserves for decades. And now this is bearing fruit. You can't just all of a sudden stand them up next to the active duty and expect them to be able to accomplish the same thing with subpar training and inferior equipment. But absolutely, the National Guard and Reserve especially are really, as a general who recently testified before the Armed Services Committee testified, it's near its breaking point. These people had no idea this was coming, and definitely not to this extent, and they haven't been adequately prepared for it. And it definitely does have an effect. As you said, we've got about 40-50% of our force right now in the Middle East is comprised of National Guard and Reserves, and that's a critical factor to take in mind.
Paul, or Lieutenant Rykoff, I should say, you were there, you saw it on the ground, you were on all kinds of missions, and National Guardsmen are doing very in-the-thick-of-it missions in Iraq. You say it's near the breaking point. What's the evidence? What kind of scenes did you see there that would bring that home to American listeners?
Well, I think what you saw yesterday, for example, on the policy front, is that the National Guard's having a hard time meeting their recruiting. What I saw in my unit is four extensions. We came into this part of the initial invasion with the 3rd Infantry Division. We were told we'd be going home in July, initially. July became September. September became October. October became November. We finally came home in February. Now, the soldiers are going to suck it up. They're going to do their jobs, and they're going to do what the Army asks of them. But the family on the back end is really, really going to be stretched, and that's where the damage is really being done. And it's hard to plan your life when you don't know when you're coming home. And the Army makes a promise, gives expectations, and then yanks them out from under you. That's really, really demoralizing and will have a long-term effect on both retention and recruiting.
But you've re-upped, Paul. What do you think needs to be done here? Are you saying the National Guard is not playing its correct role in Iraq? They need to build up the active duty force so that can step in? What's your recommendation?
Well, the first step is recognizing that we didn't have enough people at the outset and we don't have enough people now. That's the bottom line. We went in with an adequate number of people. We've been playing Band-Aid solutions ever since. You've got to do one of two things. You've either got to change your foreign policy or change the military. And you're not going to change the foreign policy, it looks like, at least Bush won't. So you've got to find ways to augment or supplement the military. And you can do that in one of three ways. Either you bring in the international coalition, which doesn't look likely right now. You increase the size of the active duty, which you've got to find a way to pay for. Or you talk about the draft. And that's definitely a political suicide pill right now. Nobody's even going to talk about it. It's the 800-pound gorilla in the room nobody wants to discuss.
Do you think it's a good idea?
The draft?
Yeah.
I don't know if it's a good idea, but it's definitely a contingency on a general's plate somewhere. If I'm a high-level military planner, I've got to think about what do I do if Korea comes across the DMZ? What do I do if Iran and Syria decide to do a backdoor pact and invade Iraq? You've got to plan that contingency, and the American public is sleeping. They have no idea that this is even a consideration, and it is.
Lieutenant Rykoff, Cindy Williams, John White, stand by. I want to begin to bring our callers into this conversation. David is on the line from Hyde Point, North Carolina. Hi, David. You're on the air.
Oh, hi. How are you? You know, I can't agree more with the lieutenant. In fact, you know, my first point is simply that I will vote for the first commander in chief, for the current commander in chief, because you really don't change a commander in the middle of a heated battle. To that point, this commander will probably initiate a draft after reshuffling the U.S. troops worldwide, and I might emphasize after the election. And this, as the lieutenant so aptly put it, would never be suggested before this election because it would be political suicide, but it is crucial to undertake.
Do you think it's a good idea, David, a draft?
I absolutely do because, you know, first of all, our assets are those brave souls in the field who fight for freedom here at home and worldwide. And how can we win a war if these assets are wearing out? We need a draft to relieve the pressure, and it certainly would not hurt the younger generation to take pride in this wonderful country and serve it. You know, there's a price to pay. Freedom is not free, as they say.
David, we've got it. Let us pick that up. Cindy Williams, thanks for your call, David. Cindy Williams, here's the word. There may be a lot of other options, but everybody thinks of the draft. And I know young people these days are thinking about it. If this goes on, will I be drafted? Is that on the table? Should it be on the table or not?
I don't think it's really on the table. I know there's a rumor, a big internet rumor, that says the administration is just waiting until after the election to announce that there will be a draft. I think the military is a long ways from needing a draft to solve its current problems. Even if we had to double the size of the deployable army, we could do that by stepping up recruitment every year, just by slightly lowering the quality that we expect of the troops who
of the new recruits. You're saying they're turning away enough where they could pump up the marketing, more Army of One ads?
They're turning away a lot of people who can't make the clip that they're insisting on right now.
But if they do that, what about this high-tech Army? Would it still operate with a lower standard?
One of the things that's interesting is that the clip rate they're running at right now is very high relative to their own standards.
What do you mean by clip rate?
Those
that they don't accept, they apply and don't accept.
Yes, so they could accept a lot more people with just a slightly lower level of cognitive ability and still have all the capability that they have for
a high-tech
military.
But you don't think they'll go for the draft? You just don't see it?
I don't think that the senior uniformed military wants a draft for that. I don't think we're anywhere needing to adopt a draft to fill the ranks.
We're going to have to give that some more attention. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're joined now from Waterville, Maine, by General John Libby. He's Adjutant General of the Maine National Guard. General Libby, thanks very much for being with us tonight.
Thanks for having me.
Well, here we are. Your National Guard's been carrying a lot of weight in Iraq. What is the impact on the Guard overall, General Libby, on morale, on its ability to carry out its functions on the home front? We've seen hurricanes, and in Maine, you have storms, have had big ice storms in recent years where the National Guard's come out. How is this playing out for the National Guard as you see it?
Well, let me address the issue that a lot of people like to talk about, and that's our ability to respond to natural disasters or state missions, if you will. While 60% of my force structure either has been or is currently in the theater, we've always had enough troops to respond to any domestic emergency we needed to respond to. The ice storm in 98 is probably the yardstick that most people look toward in this neck of the woods. And at that particular point in time, we didn't have more than 700 troops on active duty at any particular on state active duty at any time during that period. And we've always had more than 700 troops in state. I think it's important also to recognize that all states are signatory to the Emergency Management Assistance Compact, which means if I don't have the force structure that I need to respond to a state emergency, I can request that force structure from another state. So I don't see that as having any impact.
I'm reading here earlier in the summer, General Libby, you were saying that the current pace of deployment of Maine's Army Guard troops was not sustainable. You said our recruiting is down significantly from last year. Our retention rates are always also down. You said the biggest problem is that parents are discouraging their children from joining. How's that playing out?
Well, our recruiting actually is slightly below where we were last year. Recruiting isn't the issue for us. There is an interesting dynamic there. Our target enlistee is a 17-year-old high school junior, somebody we would bring in, send off to basic training before his senior year, advanced training after his senior year, and then he goes into the job market or off to college, and we've got him as a drilling guardsman. Our 17-year-old contacts are above where they have been in recent years, but not surprisingly, they're not getting their parents to sign for them.
Mm-hmm.
But overall, our recruiting is only slightly below where it was a year ago.
And what do you think of the mission that the Guard is being put to today? Is it the right mission for the Army National Guard?
Well, I've got to disagree with some of the things I've heard already. Anybody who's joined the Guard in the decade of the 90s joined with the understanding that they were facing a potential for mobilization. Certainly at the Desert Storm, that was a pretty clear course of action that was available to anyone coming into the Guard. Our experience has been, as it relates to morale of troops, we don't have combat formations in Maine. Currently, we have an engineer combat heavy battalion deployed in northern Iraq. They're engaged in a humanitarian engineering mission up there, working daily side by side with the Kurds and having both an outstanding professional experience doing engineer things and also having a very rewarding personal experience.
Probably in one of the safest areas of the country. Lieutenant Rykoff, I hear you chomping at the bit there. What's your observation here?
Well, I think people may have been planning for the contingency of being activated and sent to war, but I'll tell you firsthand, my 38 guys definitely weren't planning on being there for a year, and their families weren't planning on being there for a year, and the people being called up right now are sacrificing essentially 18 months with a six-month train-up, and that was never really a realistic part of their expectations. It was select groups that have been sent over in the Gulf War, and definitely not the extent to which they've been called up now. And I think you've also got to address the issue that the National Guard and Reserve have been neglected, and these soldiers haven't been trained to the same extent the active duty has. They haven't been equipped the same way. My soldiers did not have body armor. We stood alongside active duty soldiers and had an adequate inferior equipment, and we were told that we got that because we were National Guard, and there wasn't enough to go around.
General Libby, we've got half a minute before the break here. How long can this go on? Is this a role that the National Guard should continue to play in Iraq, in Afghanistan, at some point, who knows, in Iran, on the Korean Peninsula, or do we need a bigger active duty military in your view?
Well, I think the lieutenant hit the nail right on the head earlier. We've either got to have a change in our foreign policy as it relates to where we go and what we do, or we've got to have a change in the size of our military. I agree with him entirely on that particular point. Both of those decisions are well above either our pay grades.
Mm. John Libby, Brigadier General, thank you very much for joining us tonight. Paul Rykoff, John White, Cindy Williams, please stand by. We're talking about the overstretched U.S. military and what will be done about it. What do you think? Does America now just need a bigger military? How would you build it? Can we afford it? And after the experience of Iraq, who's going to be signing up to join the Army, to join the Guard? Are you? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the seriously overstretched United States military. You can join the conversation if the U.S. military is short of troops. What should be done? Is the whole idea of weekend warriors now history? Is the weight of America's military ambitions being fairly shared by all Americans? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. A new Army report, Pentagon-appointed panel brought out, made public today, says current and projected force structure will not sustain our current and projected global stabilization commitments. That means Iraq, that means Afghanistan, and all that may come, not to mention if there was a real outbreak on the Korean Peninsula or elsewhere. I'm joined tonight from MIT by Cindy Williams, from Harvard's Kennedy School by John White, and from New York City by Lieutenant Paul Rykoff in the New York National Guard. He spent 10 months in combat operations as a platoon leader in Iraq. Right now, John is calling from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Hi, John. You're on the air.
Hi. I just wanted to make a comment. I was regular Army, in for about 12 years total, came out of the military academy.
Okay, yep.
And after that time, after being deployed to Iraq for about 9 months, I decided to get out. And I think that's a continuing trend you're going to see.
Why, John?
Well, a lot of the regular Army guys are sick and tired of the fast-paced deployment. I was a little unusual in that I'd had a pretty good amount of time in the Army, and a lot of my peers are stuck in a position now where they really want to get out but don't feel that they are able to because of the time commitment they've already made. However, a lot of the younger generation, a lot of the lieutenants that are regular Army are getting out left and right.
So when the stop-loss order, when the stop-loss order, when and if it's ultimately lifted, what do you expect will happen, John?
I think that you're going to see, well, you're already seeing it in some of the units where the stop-loss order has been lifted. The younger ranks, the lieutenants, the experienced leaders on the ground out that were in Iraq are getting out of the Army as quickly as they can. There's a backlog of people trying to turn in paperwork and process paperwork just to move on because they're sick of, you know, my unit was there for a total of 15 months in Iraq fighting through a lot of bad times.
And let me ask you this. Our guest, Cindy Williams from MIT, is saying that if necessary, they could recruit a lot more troops just by lowering the standard a bit on cognitive skills. What would you think of that? As a 12-year Army veteran, if the new recruits coming in just didn't have quite the shine of what you've seen so far, how would that affect the operations of the military?
I think you'd have a lot of problems. The soldiers they're absolutely wonderful. They're marvelous individuals. They'll do whatever you ask of them. But if you start bringing the standards down and lowering that, I think you're going to get some of these people who aren't of that caliber. The military had a lot of problems with that during the Vietnam era and the post-Vietnam era, especially as it transferred from a draftee force to an all-volunteer force where there are a lot of lower-caliber soldiers brought in. And I think a lot of the senior military leadership that's still around from that era, either on the civilian side or on the uniform side, still carries that burden with them, and they understand what that happens. So I don't think that's a really either a feasible goal from the military standpoint or a realistic goal. It's something that the leadership would allow to happen.
So what's your answer to the overstretch, John, as a veteran of some years?
I think the answer is simply that there's got to be a slowdown of the pace.
Of deployment, in other words, of military operations.
Right. You can't continue to deploy forces worldwide. If you want to focus the forces, you've got to really pick where you want to do it, and we can't continue to deploy soldiers anywhere there's a desire. Under the current administration, we've overstretched the military to the point where, you know, no one wants to stay anymore. No one's willing to do it, or very few are willing to do it.
John, I appreciate your call. It's so good of you to call in. I want to hear some more from our callers. We've got some good ones. Jonathan's calling from Canton, Massachusetts. Hi, Jonathan. You're on the air.
Good evening. How are you?
Good evening. Fine, thank you.
I'll give you my synopsis very quickly first. I have a son who, when we first went into Afghanistan, was part of the 101st Airborne.
Okay.
He served 10 months in Afghanistan.
Mm-hmm.
And then he came back from Afghanistan and was first into Iraq again, left for Iraq January of 2003, came back from Iraq in November of 2003. He had re-upped before he went to Iraq and was told after he was done in Iraq, he could transfer. He transferred to Hawaii to the 23rd Infantry.
Yeah.
So once he got to Hawaii, he then found out that in January of 2004, so he was home for 2.5 months,
right,
he went back to Iraq.
Ooh, quick turnaround.
A very quick turnaround for all three deployments.
How's he handling it? How's he handling it, Jonathan?
Well, the other side of it is when he got to Iraq, just before he left for Iraq, he was complaining about headaches and depression. And he didn't complete the testing in Hawaii. They had ordered him to stay behind, but the orders, for whatever reason, never made it to his commander, or his commander overrode the order. And apparently they have the right to do that. Once he got to Iraq, since January, they put him on three different medications, one for depression, one for anxiety, and another one for headaches. He came home for a two-week R&R in April of this year and attempted to be seen by a military doctor at Hanscom Air Force Base in Massachusetts. That military doctor refused to do anything or do any tests because he didn't want to override the doctor who had seen my son in Hawaii, who is now deployed in Iraq.
In other words, your son may be suffering from an anxiety that means he shouldn't be there, but they don't want to look at that because they need him there.
They need him there. They told him when he went to Hawaii that they needed him there because the vast majority of soldiers in Hawaii, including a lot of the career officers, hadn't really seen any action since you know, the late 70s, early 80s, and just mostly training, and that they really hadn't seen very much of anything in that part of the world since Vietnam.
So you could say, what do they know? Meanwhile, your son knows a lot. Jonathan, thank you very much for sharing that story. I want to get one more call here. Jack is calling from Chicago. Hi, Jack. You're on the air.
Good evening.
Good evening.
I just wanted to put in a little different perspective. I've been in the Army National Guard in Illinois for 14 years as a physician assistant, and I do processing for people going over and coming back from Iraq. The morale has plummeted, but I see the stretch so much that they're calling back people who retired recently. I just talked to two guys. One had a hip replacement after he retired, and another guy had a knee replacement after he retired, and they've called them back.
Ouch.
And they're certified to come back and serve. They may not go to Iraq, but they've been called up to fill gaps over here. And
Jack, let me ask you, you're a guard physician's assistant. You say morale is plummeting. What's the evidence of that?
Well, the interviews that I talk when I talk to people coming back, you can talk to them and you can identify the stress in the conversations, and if they have an opportunity, most of the people you talk to aren't going to re-up, and they're trying to find ways to get out.
And let me ask you this: our last caller was saying his son was on antidepressant medication. How widespread is that in the military now, given the stress they're under?
Well, it is pretty widespread. So a lot of your personnel actually are being treated for depression before they even go off to Iraq. They're being treated by their private doctors in the Guard especially, and then they end up going overseas with that diagnosis already in place.
Jack, thanks very much for your insights, and thank you for your call. Cindy Williams, behind all this, there's not just a question of troop strength. There's a question of money. It's very expensive to maintain and to grow the military. Are there the resources there for a bigger military if and when the country needs it?
Well, that's a good question. You know, our all-volunteer force does cost a lot. And the military is paid quite well compared to people in the private sector. The benefits package is relatively rich, and especially rich if you look at all the benefits across the board.
You're saying the military is paid quite well? I mean,
compared to what? Compared with people with similar levels of education and experience in the private sector. Basically, the government is paying about $100,000 per troop for the pay and benefits of a troop. And
okay.
That means
okay.
that if we want to add 10,000 troops, we're talking about $1 billion every year.
Right.
Right.
And 40,000.
$4 billion. 100,000, like I said, $10 billion a year.
Yeah. And pretty soon you're talking real money over over 10 years.
Money.
That's $100 billion.
Now, you can offset that by thinking about the fact that the Navy and the Air Force are overstaffed right now. And so you're not really talking about a big net increase.
What if you find yourself in another theater in Northeast Asia? And you need the Navy and Air Force.
Right, but the Navy has already decided that it wants to cut back on its staff. The Air Force already knows that it has to cut back 24,000 people. So if you took the 84,000 people that those two services are planning to drop with no net increase in the annual cost of the force, you could pay for this. But still, it's very expensive.
Paul Rykoff, let me ask you, it sounds like a lot of these potential solutions are some time off, but the fighting in Iraq is every day. What's your concern about the situation there right now as people deal with being stretched thin?
Well, I think the bigger picture is that the wheels are coming off, and I think you're hearing it from all different directions, but the soldiers have known this for, 6 months or a year. The military is being run into the ground, and the soldiers know it, and they've been, whining about it or complaining about it. It's not really whining within, and we get reports of that. We've got a website at optruth.org where soldiers have been voicing these concerns, but the press has been slow to respond, and the country's been slow to respond, in part because you've got such a small percentage of the overall population serving in Iraq. That's really one of the casualties of the volunteer Army is that they don't get out as often.
And when you say the wheels are coming off, what do you mean exactly, Paul?
Well, you moved a brigade out of Korea into Iraq at this point. You're pulling people, thousands of people off the individual ready reserves. And morale is dropping because the military is really being abused. It wasn't created to handle this type of a workload. And the people are not being taken care of, and they know that. You heard about the soldiers coming home with emotional problems. Post-traumatic stress disorder is a ticking time bomb. Soldiers in my unit are affected by it. The numbers increase every day. And my 38 guys alone, each week it seems like another guy or two calls me up and says, hey, LT, I'm another one. I got PTSD. We had a soldier in our company about 2 months ago kill himself. The suicide rate is another issue that has really not been given any visibility yet. We know within that the military is really hurting right now. But it's a culture where we don't talk about it. We drive on, and we just do our jobs. But people around the country need to help us understand why the military is at risk and connect with the military. That's what's really missing right now, is the connection between the civilian and the military world.
Well, we're trying to make it right here. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Scott is calling from Eau Claire, Wisconsin. Hi, Scott. You're on the air.
Oh, hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Good to have you, Scott.
I just wanted to make a comment. I'm in the Air National Guard and an F-16 pilot and currently waiting to go over there, too. And I agree with most of the callers in here about the morale in the Air National Guard is the worst I've seen it since I got in 1989. And we're just going all the time. And if the airlines weren't doing as bad as they would, I don't think you'd have all the pilots in the Air National Guard right now filling the cockpits.
But Scott, you know what people say. They say when you sign up for the National Guard, you know what the deal is. You may be called up, so?
Yeah, and I agree with that. And we're all ready to go. But, you know, we feel like we should be supplementing the Air Force over there. We feel like we're doing the main, fighting and flying over there, and I feel real sorry for the Army National Guard guys, but we kind of feel the same way where we're doing this whole year now is training to go to Iraq, and there's really no end in sight.
Scott, when do you ship out, Scott?
We're training to go for March. On our AEF deployment over there.
And how long do you expect to be there?
Well, it was supposed to be 90 days, and now they're saying it's 120 days.
We wish you luck, Scott. Good luck on your deployment.
Thanks a lot.
Thanks for calling. John White, where's the solution here?
I think the solution lies in in realigning the force. Two things, realigning the force, cutting back on the places where we don't need forces, as Cindy said, the Navy and the Air Force. I think we have to reorganize the National Guard. I think the observations are correct that people didn't sign up for this, and we have to rethink the model that we have there. And finally, I think we have to rethink our worldwide reach. That is, we have a policy of total engagement around the world. We don't have the force necessary to do that, and we ought to realize that.
And what about Paul Rykoff's point of view that the problem is that Americans just aren't engaged enough in the military to know how great the stress is?
I think that's very important, and I think people have to appreciate the great sacrifices made by the military. And we, the citizens, we have a contract with all these brave airmen and soldiers, Marines, and so on, and we have an obligation to them as individuals, and we're beginning to break that obligation by overstretching this force.
Well, it has been an hour of insights, and I thank all of you for helping us gain them. John White from the Harvard Kennedy School of Government, former Assistant Secretary of Defense, Deputy Secretary of Defense, thanks so much for being with us tonight.
Thank you.
And Cindy Williams, Principal Research Scientist in Security Studies Program at Massachusetts Institute of Technology. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks very much, Tom.
And in New York, Paul Rykoff, Lieutenant in the New York National Guard, Executive Director and Founder of Operation Truth, the man who has re-upped in spite of all this. Thank you very much for being with us, Lieutenant Rykoff.
My pleasure, sir. Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.